constructed warships in Levantine ports and in Alexandria, and this is reflected in contemporary papyri, which depict a scene of frenzied activity as carpenters, caulkers, joint sealers, blacksmiths, and oarsmen were press-ganged into service, and supplies were commandeered for the soldiers and crew. There were the usual large troop-carrying vessels, numbering some 300, which were able to transport 1,000 elite cavalry on each one, and they also bore various items of military hardware, such as catapults and towers, which would enable them to breach walls or to scale them. In addition, however, there were special lightships with only 100 men aboard, so that they might rapidly dart to and fro over the waves of the sea around the very large ships, which would, it was hoped, give the Arab fleet a tactical advantage. The plan was that Muawiyah would march by land as far as Chalcedon, which lay across the Bosphorus from Constantinople, while the general Abu al-Awar would command the Arab armada and sail up to the Byzantine capital. Map 4.1. There was some delay because of a minor incident in Levantine Tripoli. Two men broke down the gates of the city prison and liberated numerous Byzantine captives, and together they slew the governor of the city along with his retinue and burned all the ships moored in the port before escaping in a small boat to Byzantium. Muawiyah was furious, but refused to let his plans be derailed. He went ahead to Chalcedon while Abu al-Awar oversaw the completion of the shipbuilding before he too set off, probably in the summer of 654. When they were approaching Phoenix, off the coast of Lycia, south of modern Antalya, they encountered a Byzantine fleet led by the Emperor Constans himself and his brother. That both of them accompanied the fleet in person is a measure of how seriously they viewed the threat. In the event, the light vessels of the Arabs easily outmaneuvered the large, cumbersome Byzantine ships. It looked like the emperor himself might be captured, but one foresighted soldier whisked his master onto another ship in time to make a fast getaway, while another man courageously put on the imperial robes and stationed himself bravely on the imperial ship, killing many of the enemy before giving up his life on behalf of the king. The emperor and his brother sailed as swiftly as they could back to Constantinople, while the rest of the Byzantine fleet was cut to pieces on a sea so violent that it was said that dense spray ascended among the ships like dust from dry land, and that the sea was dyed with blood. Abu al-Awar ordered that they fish out the corpses of the Byzantines, and their number was estimated at some 20,000. The Arab fleet continued toward Constantinople, chasing the surviving Byzantine ships as far as Rhodes. The capital's inhabitants were now nervous, since they knew about the Arabs' approach by land and by sea, and were shaken by the naval defeat at Phoenix. The emperor entered the church of Hagia Sophia and implored God to aid the city. He lifted the crown from his head, put aside the purple, donned sackcloth, and sat on ashes, and ordered a fast to be proclaimed in Constantinople. As the Arabs drew near in the early autumn of 654, Abu al-Awar ordered the ships to be deployed in lines and to attack the city, but out of nowhere a storm brewed, a miracle worked by God to save the Byzantine capital, said its inhabitants. The sea was stirred up from the depths, its waves piled up high like the summits of very high mountains, and together with the raging wind broke up the Arab ships and sent their war machines and sailors plunging headlong into the seething ocean. When the Arabs encamped at Chalcedon saw the power of the storm and the destruction it wrought, they slipped away by night and began the long march home. A contingent that Muawiyah had left near Cappadocian Caesarea, modern Kayseri, to safeguard his rear, attempted to salvage some honor and attacked the local Byzantine garrison. But even here the Arabs were defeated, and they were obliged to flee to safety in northern Mesopotamia. Muslim historians do not mention this defeat, focusing instead on the victory at Phoenix, which is called in Arabic the Battle of the Masts. However, there are good reasons to give Sebeos's narrative credence. He was a contemporary of these events, writing in the early 660s, so less than a decade after they occurred. Moreover, he recounts the whole affair with such a wealth of detail that it is difficult to believe it could all have been manufactured. It also explains what otherwise would seem to make no sense, that is, why the Arab fleet, having got the Byzantines on the run, would have simply given up at this point and gone home. Byzantium enjoyed a period of relative calm while Muawiyah was distracted by civil war at home. But then, in 667, the Byzantine commander of the Armenian army, a man named Shabur, rebelled against Constance and sought the aid of the Caliph Muawiyah in his bid to win the rule of the Byzantine Empire for himself. This event is narrated very vividly and at great length by a near contemporary Syrian author. The drama takes place at the court of Muawiyah in Damascus. An envoy of Shabur named Sergius arrives there to plead his master's case before the caliph. On receiving news of this mutiny, Emperor Constance dispatches his chamberlain, the eunuch Andrew, to appeal to Muawiyah not to become involved in this plot. Sergius is portrayed as weak and fawning. He initially prostrates himself before his superior, Andrew, but then, goaded and mocked by Muawiyah for his cowardly obsequiousness, he taunts Andrew for his lack of the appurtenances of manhood. Andrew is the hero of the story. He does not tremble before the caliph, but upbraids him for failing to distinguish between a legitimate sovereign and a perfidious insurgent, and he sternly warns the rebel's messenger of the consequences of his disrespectfulness. All works out well for the hero, for Sergius is captured on his return to Armenia and killed with his testicles placed next to him, a fitting punishment for one so proud of his private parts, and Shabur has his brains dashed out when his horse rears up as he was passing through a city gate. This left Muawiyah in something of a quandary, for he had already sent troops to Shabur under the command of the highly respected Faddalah ibn Ubayd al-Ansari. When the latter learned of the death of Shabur, he wrote to Muawiyah asking what he should do. The caliph determined to take this opportunity to launch another major assault on the Byzantine capital. He ordered Faddalah to winter in Melitene, in southern Anatolia, and dispatched his son Yazid with a large body of cavalry to catch up with Faddalah, and then for the two of them to march on toward Constantinople. This they did, and by the summer of 668 they had reached Chalcedon. In the meantime, a fleet was readied and dispatched. The Emperor Constantine IV, on being informed of this major expedition advancing toward Constantinople, had large birim boats built and ordered them to be stationed at the city's eastern harbor. In the following year, the Arab fleet set sail and came to anchor in the region of Thrace, to the southwest of the capital, on the European shore. Every day there was a military engagement from morning until evening, with thrust and counter-thrust, and this went on from spring until autumn. Neither side landed a fatal blow on the other, and so, as the weather deteriorated, the Arabs looked for somewhere to spend the winter. They captured the ancient city of Cyzicus, just across the Sea of Marmara from Constantinople, and there made secure their fleet. The following spring they set out once more, and the naval jousting match recommenced. For 2 years, in 668 and 669, the blockade of the imperial city continued. We know this from a contemporary archivist who went to retrieve some documents during a council at Constantinople in 681 and found a synodical letter of the Patriarch Thomas, 667 to 669, to the Pope, which was still sealed and which he had not been able to send for the 2 years that he was patriarch, because of the prolonged incursion of the impious Saracens and their siege. It is not certain what led to the end of this blockade, but one early chronicle says that the Arabs maintained it until they could no longer bear the pain of hunger and pestilence, at which point the land force returned, plundering Anatolian towns along the way. 2 other factors might have tipped the balance in favor of the Byzantines. The first is that the Emperor Constantine had ships brought from the central Mediterranean, still outside the control of the Arabs, then along the coast of Greece, and finally driven on rollers overland across the Gallipoli Peninsula, an arduous task, but presumably the only way to bring in naval reinforcements while the Hellespont was blocked by the Arabs. The second is that the Byzantines had invented a new weapon, namely, Greek fire. Its discovery is attributed to a certain Callinicus, an architect or carpenter from Baalbek in Syria, who had come from there as a refugee to the Byzantine Empire. He concocted a flaming substance called naphthalene, which could be directed at enemy ships by means of a long metal siphon. This weapon the Byzantines were to put to good effect time and time again. In 673, for example, an Arab raiding party reached Lycia by boat, but those who disembarked were routed by a substantial Byzantine force headed by 3 generals, and those who escaped by sea were treated to a dose of Greek fire administered by some Byzantine skiffs that had managed to catch up with them. Caucasia. The Emperor Constans also had to worry about Byzantium's eastern flank because of the pact that had been concluded in 653 between the Armenian commander Theodore Rishtuni and the Arabs. Not only was Armenia a long-standing and close ally, but also it was an important source of military manpower and a crucial bulwark against any attack from the east. Constans had written a number of letters to Theodore urging him to reinstate the long-standing alliance between their realms, but received no answer. He decided then to go in person, and in the summer of 653 he set off with a huge military escort, a display of strength evidently intended to impress, heading for Karin, now called Erzurum in modern eastern Turkey. On the way, an Arab delegation brought Constans a message from Muawiyah, warning him, "Armenia is mine. Do not go there. But if you do go, I shall attack you and shall make sure that you cannot escape." However, Constans dismissed it contemptuously, saying that it was for God to judge such matters. Once at Karin, he stayed for a few days to meet and talk with those Armenian princes still loyal to him, who explained the intentions of Theodore and the frequent coming and going to him of envoys from the Arabs. Constans then sent back the majority of the army and continued with a smaller retinue to Divin, where he stayed with the head of the Armenian church, celebrating the liturgy with him so as to emphasize the closeness of the Byzantine-Armenian relationship. At this point, news came from Constantinople that the Arabs were planning an attack on the capital itself, and Constans was obliged to cut short his trip and return in haste. He gave command of the Byzantine army in Armenia to the patrician Marianus, with orders that he keep nudging the Armenian princes back into allegiance with Byzantium. However, Theodore Rishtuni received reinforcements of 7,000 Arab soldiers and was easily able, once the winter had passed, to put the Byzantine troops to flight, driving them back to the Black Sea coast. This, plus the rumors circulating about the huge assault being unleashed upon Constantinople, impelled the rest of the Armenian princes to submit to the Arabs. Theodore now went in honor to Damascus to offer Muawiyah presents and to receive from him robes of gold and a banner of his own colors, and most important, the rank of Prince of Armenia, along with oversight of Georgia Albania, and Siunik. These three principalities had been allied to the Persian Empire, but with the latter now defunct, Theodore could hope to bring them back into the fold of the greater Armenian kingdom that had existed before AD 428. News of the devastating defeat of the Arab expeditionary force to Constantinople began to filter through to Caucasia in the autumn of 654, and it had the double effect of weakening the morale of the Arabs campaigning there and stiffening the resolve of those opposing them. The Arab unit stationed by Divin, headed by the general Habib ibn Maslama, a merciless executioner, thought to attack Georgia, whose inhabitants were warned that they should either submit or abandon their country. The Georgians ignored these threats and vowed to fight to the last man, but in the end they were spared the trouble, for the Arab advance was beset by heavy snow and forced to retreat. The patrician Marianus and his men, who had spent much of 654 lying low in Trebizond, now felt confident enough to attempt once more to carry out the instructions imparted to them by the Emperor Constans, namely, to recapture Armenia for Byzantium. First, they harried the retreating Arabs, who were unaccustomed to the extreme cold and unwilling to fight. Rather than return to their previous quarters at Divin, they crossed the Araxes River and kept going south to the plains around Lake Urmia. Marianus took the opportunity to sack the fortress of Divin and to attack the stronghold of Nakhchivan some 70 miles to the southeast. On top of all this, the inhabitants of Media, northwest Iran, threw off their submission to the Arabs and killed the chief of the tax collectors. Seeking to further his northern alliance against the Arabs, Constans at once sent an emissary to the Prince of the Medes and made peace proposals to him, and received many gifts from him in return. In order to regain at least some of their prestige and avoid an all-out rebellion on many fronts, the Arabs now needed to make a show of strength, and so two regiments were hurriedly dispatched to the north from Iraq. One contingent, headed by Habib ibn Maslama, had the objective of regaining control of Armenia. In the spring of 655, they moved against the Byzantines, who were besieging Nakhchivan. With relative ease, they defeated them, slaying many while the rest fled, including Marianus himself. The Arabs continued on to Karin. Its inhabitants, ill-equipped to offer military resistance, opened the gates of the city, submitted, and yielded up a substantial quantity of gold and silver and other precious goods. Thereafter, the Arabs ravaged all the land of Armenia, Albania, and Siunik, and stripped all the churches. They seized as hostages the leading princes of the country, and the wives, sons, and daughters of many people. A second Arab contingent was charged with the job of taming the eastern side of Caucasia. According to Muslim sources, it was captained by the veteran soldier Salman ibn Rabia al-Bahili, and their goal was the Khazar forward base of Balanjar in modern Dagestan. They headed for the coastal region of the Caspian Sea, and then marched northward towards the people by the Caspian Gates. They passed the fortress city of Darbond, called by the Arabs the Gate of Gates, Bab al-Abwab, a reference to its location at the start of the east-west wall constructed by the Sasanians as part of a trans-Caucasian barrier to keep out the barbarians to the north. At first, they encountered only a local defensive force, the guards of that place, but then a large army of nomads appeared on the scene and they caught the Arabs in a classic pincer movement. One branch attacked them from the front, while another came up behind them, cutting off their retreat. The only escape was up through the difficult terrain of the Caucasus Mountains, and only a very few, naked and unshod, on foot and wounded, reached the area of Ctesiphon, their own homeland. These nomads were almost certainly the Khazars, who were at this time establishing themselves in the southern Russian steppe and northern Caucasia, and beginning to flex their muscles. Theodore Rushduni died in 655, and he was succeeded as Prince of Armenia by his son-in-law Hamazasp Mamikonian, a virtuous man in all respects, but he was not trained and experienced in the details of military skill. The major Arab defeat, plus the outbreak of civil war among the Arabs in 656, emboldened Hamazasp, who sought to live up to the valiant character of his ancestral house, to abandon submission to the Arabs and resume ties once more with the Byzantine Empire. This change of allegiance was warmly welcomed by Constance, who gave him silver cushions and the rank of Prince of Armenia. There was a high price to pay for this policy, though, for a furious Muawiyah rounded up all the hostages that had been brought from that region and had them all put to death, about 1,775 people. All the princes of Siunik and Albania followed suit with the Armenians and pledged allegiance to Emperor Constance. This meant that there was a Christian pro-Byzantine coalition across Caucasia, and Constance took full advantage of the respite granted him by the Arab Civil War to try to strengthen this bulwark against the Arabs. In his 19th regnal year, 659 to 660, he set off on a grand procession through the region, meeting local lords and handing out gifts and titles. Djuanshair, Prince of Albania, came to meet him in Media, which Constance hoped also to wrest from Arab control. He took the Holy Cross and cut off a piece in Djuanshair's presence and gave it to him, saying, "Let this be a tower of strength for yourself and your sons against the enemy." By 661, however, the Arab civil war was at an end, and Muawiyah was reasserting his authority over the conquered lands. Djuanshair observed how the emperor of Byzantium had been rendered powerless and weak by the Arabs, who had consumed the former's populous markets and cities like a flame, and he became worried that they might do the same to his lands. He therefore determined to switch sides and join the Arabs. In the year 664, he prepared magnificent presents and took them to salute the conqueror of the world. Muawiyah received him with great pomp and ceremony and set his seal to a treaty of sincere and perpetual friendship between them. On his return, Djuanshair met with a number of Armenian nobles who apparently received him with honor, and so it is likely that they had made a similar decision, and that Byzantium's Caucasian bulwark had already crumbled. To reinforce his writ, Muawiyah had appointed Gregory Mamikonian, who had been a hostage in Damascus, to be the Prince of Armenia, and returned him to his country with great honors. During all the time that he served in this capacity, 662 to 685, Gregory was able to maintain Armenia free from all marauding and attack, and this perhaps explains the many churches that were constructed there in his time. For the moment, then, though they had to submit to the yoke of vassalage of the King of the South, these Caucasian princes did at least retain their status and exercised a free hand within their realms. And the Second Arab Civil War, 683 to 692, gave them further respite, for during this time the Armenians, the Georgians, and the Albanians ceased to pay tribute to the Arabs. In some ways, things had not changed so much for the lords of Caucasia. As before, they were torn between two empires. It was just that now the Arabs had taken the place of the Persians. Northern Iran and the Eastern Frontier. Maps 3.3 and 4.2. Like Caucasia, Northern Iran and Central Asia were endowed with the sort of terrain that impeded easy conquest, and they were able to retain a fair degree of independence throughout the 7th century. As well as the mountain ranges of the Elburz in the north, the Kapet Dagh in the northeast, the Peloponnesus and Hindu Kush in the east, there are a number of deserts that hamper travel. The Kavir and Lut in the center, the Karakum to the northeast, and the Margo and Rigistan to the southeast. It goes without saying, then, that the conquest of this land by the Arabs proceeded very slowly. By 652, they had a grip on the western central plateau around Nihawand and on the southwest provinces of Khuzestan, Fars, and Kirman. But the north and the east had experienced little more than opportunistic raiding. The only major Arab garrison was at Merv, and even here the troops were not permanently settled, but came on rotation from Iraq. Arab rule was still, therefore, very precarious, but the death of Yazdgird and the flight of his sons to the east meant that there was no obvious person to lead a comeback, and most of the region's potentates were happy to do deals with the new rulers in exchange for being left alone. For example, when the Arabs approached Merv al-Rud in modern northwest Afghanistan, its local lord sent a letter asking them to respect the agreement that his great-grandfather had made with the Emperor Khusro I after killing the serpent that used to eat people, which had exempted his family from tax and guaranteed its hereditary governorship of the region. The Arabs mostly accepted these requests, since it gave them the time they needed to gradually establish an administrative infrastructure and to win over or strike down individual nobles and cities one by one, rather than en masse. Northern Iran. There are three distinct sectors in northern Iran. On the west side is Azerbaijan, extending southwest from the western shores of the Caspian Sea. Its governor, based at the capital of Ardabil, had initially opposed the Arabs, but when the latter promised not to kill or enslave anyone or to destroy any fire temples and to allow them to maintain their observance of Zoroastrianism and their traditional dancing festivals, he agreed to a treaty. In return, the Arabs received yearly tribute and the right to station a garrison in the capital. In the center are the Caspian provinces, separated from the central Iranian plateau by the Elburz Mountains and blessed with a rich and varied flora due to the humidity of the Caspian Sea. This isolation favored strong local identities and willful petty rulers, who are celebrated in a large number of local histories drafted in medieval times. They would demand a treaty one time, complained one Muslim author, but then refuse to pay the tribute the next time, continually starting war and suing for peace. The ruler of Tabaristan, also known as Mazandaran, was particularly independent-minded, and it was known even to the Chinese, to whose court he sent emissaries, that he refused to submit to the Arabs. Arab generals did, every now and then, have a go at asserting their authority over these regions, but most left with a bloody nose. In 674, for example, Maskala ibn Hubeira headed for Tabaristan with 10,000 men seeking to take charge of the land assigned to him, but when they began to ascend the steep valleys, the locals rolled down rocks onto their heads, wiping out much of that army. Maskala was obliged to make peace with the people, recognizing their autonomy, in return for payment of 500,000 dirhams, 100 shawls, and 300 head of slaves. Finally, on the east side are the fertile plains of Gurgan and the steppe lands of Dihistan, sandwiched between the Caspian Sea and the Karakum Desert, where the Persian emperor Peroz met his end in AD 484. These were the preserve of the Turkish Chol, Arabic Sul, dynasty, which had already made its home there before the Arab conquests. The region was left alone until the reign of Suleiman, 715 to 717, who dispatched the redoubtable general Yazid ibn al-Muhallab to seek its submission. He besieged the incumbent monarch for several months, but was not able to obtain his surrender and agreed to leave on condition of payment of tribute. As soon as he had gone, the locals threw off their allegiance and killed the agent of the government who had been left behind. This provoked a furious reaction from Yazid, who fought them for months until they finally surrendered, and this time, he gibbeted their warriors. And in fulfillment of an earlier threat, he made bread from their blood and ate it. Thus, this country reluctantly became part of the Arab Empire, though, like the other Caspian provinces, it retained its distinctiveness and detachedness from the central government for many centuries to come. The Northeast Frontier. The eastern frontier of Iran effectively fell into a northern sector and a southern sector, which lay on either side of the imposing Hindu Kush mountain range. The northern sector was dominated by the upper reaches of the Oxus and Jaxartes rivers, and was bounded to the west by the Karakum Desert and to the north by the Kizilkum Desert. It was a world divided into numerous micro-regions by these mountains, rivers, and deserts, and this topographical diversity was matched by political diversity, with a bewildering array of princes and lords ruling over discrete locales. The most important principalities were Tukharistan, ancient Bactria, centered around Balkh in the very north of modern Afghanistan, and Sogdia, which comprised the cities that were strung out along the Zarafshan River, together with their agricultural hinterlands, in particular Bukhara and Samarkand in modern Uzbekistan. This northern sector was much richer than its southern counterpart, especially Sogdia, the inhabitants of which had managed to establish themselves in the pre-Islamic period as the chief middlemen in the overland trade between China, Iran, and Byzantium. This means that it is also better documented than its southern counterpart, both attracting more attention from the world powers, especially China, and even providing us with some local sources in the native languages of Bactrian and Sogdian. These help to bring out the diversity of this land, for whereas Muslim authors tended only to see infidels, contemporary texts make clear that Islam had to jostle for position with Zoroastrianism, Buddhism, Manichaeism, and Christianity for a good while. And where Muslim authors tended to label everyone as Turks or Persians, other texts can help to bring out the rich tapestry of local identities that existed in this region. The Chinese pilgrim Xuanzang traveled through this region in the early 7th century, and he reveals something of this complex mosaic. The country was divided, he tells us, into 27 states, each with separate chiefs, but all subject to the Turks. He had arrived shortly before the empire of the Western Turks disintegrated under pressure from a resurgent China. Nevertheless, their Khagan, leader, still seemed an impressive figure to Xuanzang, who paid him a visit in the year 629 to 630 in the vicinity of Lake Issyk-Kul in modern Kyrgyzstan. He was surrounded by about 200 high-ranking companions, Tarkhans, all clothed in brocade, with their hair braided. On the right and the left he was attended by troops clad in furs and fine-spun hair garments, carrying lances, bows, and standards, and mounted on camels and horses. They sat in a pavilion adorned with golden flower ornaments which blinded the eye with their glitter. The officers, kitted out in resplendent garments of embroidered silk, had spread out mats, and all the while the Khagan's bodyguard stood behind in readiness. Food, wine, and conversation followed, and the pilgrim was sent off with warm regards and commendations, bearing gifts of red satin vestments and 50 pieces of silk. But not long afterward, this Khagan was killed in a revolt against his authority, and the regime he headed faltered, its last leader dying a prisoner in China in 659. The Arabs thus arrived at a time when there was something of a power vacuum at the top. The Chinese Emperor Gaozong, 650 to 683, claimed the area formerly overseen by the Turks, since he regarded the latter as vassals of China. But in practical terms, this meant little, given the difficulty of the terrain and its considerable distance from the imperial heartlands. Circumstances would change at the end of the 7th century, when the Turks reasserted their authority and posed a serious threat to the Arabs. But until then, the latter had no option but to deal with all the myriad chiefs of this region individually, whether by force or by diplomacy. The first Arab to tackle the subjugation of this northern sector was Abdallah ibn Amr, the energetic and capable governor of Basra, 649 to 656, and 661 to 664. He had first set about obtaining the submission of Merv and the smaller settlements of Khorasan, such as Nishapur and Sarakhs, then moved eastward into what is now western Afghanistan. Usually treaties were agreed that guaranteed life and property in return for an annual cash payment, though sometimes slaves, animals, and foodstuffs were given as well or instead. The apportionment of the tribute among the population was the responsibility of the local grandees, dehkans, and the Muslims had only to take receipt of it. An expeditionary force entered Tukharistan in modern North Afghanistan and agreed to terms with Balkh, a rich agricultural oasis and a renowned center of Buddhism, but did not cross the Oxus River. Ibn Amr himself negotiated with the leaders beyond this watery boundary, agreeing not to go over to their side as long as they gave tribute of cattle, male and female slaves, silk, and garments. During the First Arab Civil War, 656 to 661, however, all these gains were reversed, for all of northeast Iran took the opportunity to throw off its allegiance. When Ziyad ibn Abi Sufyan took charge of the whole of Persia for Muawiyah in 670, he was able to bring some order and consistency to the Arab approach to their eastern frontier lands. He centralized the administration at Merv and settled in and around this city 50,000 families from Iraq, presumably with promises of lucrative rewards for those campaigning in this gateway to the east. This meant that there was now a local base of operations and a pool of military manpower, which made it much easier to launch sorties into Transoxania, the lands beyond the Oxus River, than before, when troops had to be drawn from faraway Basra. Subsequent governors of Khorasan took advantage of this resource to try to advance Arab control in the region. Ziyad's own son Ubaydallah, 673 to 676, was the first Arab to cross the River Oxus to Bukhara, marching against and defeating the Bukhar Huda, the Lord of Bukhara, who ruled the wealthy emporia of Pekand and Bukhara. At this point, the local historical tradition focuses on the person of the Bukhar Huda's wife, referred to simply as the Khatun, the lady, and celebrated for her wisdom and capable management. Her husband died leaving an infant son, and so she assumed control, acting as the regent of the country for 15 years and making deals with various Arab leaders in the best interests of her subjects. Every day, it is said, she would ride out of the fortress on a horse, and halting at the gate of the forage sellers, she would sit on a throne, while before her stood slaves, eunuchs, and nobles. Standing at a distance were 200 youths from the landowners and the princes, ready for service, girded with gold belts and bearing swords. As soon as she appeared, all made obeisance to her and stood in two rows while she inquired into the affairs of state and issued orders and prohibitions. In 676, she provided a contingent of Bukharans to support an Arab assault against that other jewel in the crown of this land, Samarkand, the capital of the Sogdians. Though the latter resisted, they quickly submitted when the Arabs, aided by a local guide, targeted the castle in which were the sons of their kings and nobles, fearing that all of them might be killed. The Arabs were, then, making solid, if slow, gains during Muawiyah's reign, but the debilitating civil war that erupted upon the death of Yazid I in 683 reversed this process, and it was another 2 decades before they were able to recuperate their losses. The Southeast Frontier. The core part of the southern sector of the Arabs' eastern frontier equated roughly to the eastern and southern parts of modern Afghanistan and the northwest of modern Pakistan, and comprised cities such as Zarang, Bust, Kandahar, Kabul, and Kapisa. These were difficult lands to traverse, owing to the prevalence of harsh deserts and high mountains, but in the southwest, the Helmand and Argandab rivers made agriculture possible, and in the east, rich seams of precious metals, especially the silver mines of Panjshir, provided a good living for its inhabitants. The Arabs established reasonable control over Zarang and its hinterland, especially in the time of the long-serving governor Abd al-Rahman ibn Samura, 654 to 656 and 661 to 670. This was in the west of the province of Sistan. To the east, separated from Zarang by the Margo Desert, the going was much harder, especially in the Hindu Kush Mountains. Here there were a number of local rulers, such as the Rutbils in Aruhaj, ancient Arakosia, and Zabulistan, and the Kabul Shahs and Kingals in the area of Kabul and Gandhara, around modern Peshawar in northwest Pakistan, who, as we can see from their coinage, maintained their rule and distinctive artistic and religious traditions. At the western end of the Hindu Kush was the province of Badghis, which, with its capital Herat, was one of the last holdouts of the Hephthalites, the people that had dominated pretty much all of Central Asia in the mid-5th to the mid-6th century, before losing out to the Turks. These various local lords were very jealous of their independence and were protected by rough terrain, and so, though they sometimes signed truces and treaties for a time, they reneged repeatedly whenever the circumstances were propitious. For example, in 654, Herat and Badghis threw off their allegiance and ejected the agent of the Arab government, apparently acting at the instigation of a member of the noble Persian Karen family. Zarang reneged 3 times, and in 671, successfully resisted an order from Ziyad ibn Abi Sufyan to kill their Zoroastrian chief priest and extinguish their sacred fires. And upon the death of Abd al-Rahman ibn Samura, the Kabul Shah rallied a force sufficiently strong to expel the Arabs from Kabul and its environs, and the Rutbil reasserted his control over Zabulistan and Aruhaj as far as Bust. A treaty was renegotiated, but about the time of the death of the Caliph Yazid I, 680 to 683, the people of Kabul treacherously broke the compact once again and routed the army sent to reimpose it, and throughout the Second Arab Civil War, the Rutbil maintained his authority by playing off the different Arab factions against one another. Africa. Map 4.3. Arab troops in North Africa also found further expansion very slow going. The core of Byzantine Africa, and subsequently of Arab Ifriqiya, consisted of the provinces of Zeugitana, or Africa Proconsularis, modern northern Tunisia, Byzacena, southern Tunisia, and Numidia, eastern Algeria. To the west was Mauritania, western Algeria and northern Morocco, dominated by the towering Atlas mountain range. The Vandals had captured this region in the 430s, and it remained in their hands for a century before being retaken by the Byzantines in the 530s. The Vandals had ruled with a light hand and had kept mostly to the fertile agricultural areas near to the coast, and so the residents of the interior, in the mountains and deserts, had begun to establish their own polities, which often exhibited an interesting blend of Byzantine and Moorish features. For example, an inscription of 508 from Altava in modern Western Algeria commemorates the construction of a fort on behalf of a certain Masuna, king of the peoples of the Moors and the Romans. From about the same time, but farther to the east, in the Aures Mountains of modern eastern Algeria, we have the inscription of Mastes, chief and emperor, dux et imperator, who never broke faith with the Romans or with the Moors. Moreover, many of these leaders and their subjects were Christian, as is shown by the numerous Christian tombstones of the 5th to 7th century that are found scattered about these regions. Having retaken the area, the Byzantines naturally wished to reassert their authority, but the locals had got used to running their own affairs. When the new governor of Tripolitania refused to listen to the complaints of some Moorish leaders about pillaging by Byzantine troops and had one of their leaders killed for grabbing his sleeve, a full-scale revolt ensued. It took the Byzantines 4 years to quash this uprising, 544 to 548, but this was no grand triumph. Resentment simmered on, and Byzantine rule was thereafter largely confined to the coastal plains, and the Moorish polities mostly retained their autonomy. It was therefore principally with Moorish peoples, or Berbers as they called them, that the Arabs had to contend once they had deposed Gregory, the Byzantine governor of Africa, in 647. After this, there would seem to have been no real threat from Byzantine troops, which perhaps explains why the Arabs left the western portion of North Africa alone for a long time. The next reference in a Christian source to raiding there is not until 670, when an army of Arabs invaded the region, led away about 80,000 captives, and returned to their country. The same notice is found in Muslim sources, where it is specified that it was led by Muawiyah ibn Hudayj, a general of the powerful South Arabian tribe of Kinda, and was targeted against Jalula, ancient Kalulis, in modern Tunisia. We know from a 10-line poetic inscription in Latin that a lot of restoration work, including the erection of ramparts, was carried out here around the year 540. On the lintel of one of the new city gates, accompanied by lavish ornamentation, was inscribed a poem that recorded how, by the hand of Justinian, the terror of the Moors had been replaced by sound administration, the rule of law, and the protection of strong walls. It is likely that Jalula still accommodated Byzantine troops in the 7th century and so was an obvious target for an Arab attack. Muawiyah brought catapults to weaken the sturdy fortifications, and once they were breached, he entered the city, quickly overwhelmed the fighters within, and left again with a number of captives. At about this time, the settlement of Kairouan was founded, in Inner Byzacena, about 100 miles south of Tunis. The usual date given in Muslim sources for this event is 670, which is the same year as the establishment of a permanent garrison at Merv, and so we should perhaps view these acts as a policy decision of the Caliph Muawiyah himself. As in the case of Merv, such a move was a big step forward in entrenching and stabilizing Arab rule. With a forward base in Africa, the Arabs could keep troops and supplies there and use it as a launching pad for further conquests without having to return to Alexandria, some 1,200 miles to the east as the crow flies. Mostly likely, Muawiyah ibn Hudayj was responsible for initiating its construction after his siege of Jalula, which lies 20 miles northwest of Kairouan. However, other candidates have been proposed. One early source states explicitly that Abu al-Muhajir, a freedman who had risen through the ranks of the administration in Egypt, was the first to reside in Africa, whereas everyone before him just led raiding expeditions and then returned to Egypt. Other sources favor his rival, Uqba ibn Nafi', who bore Abu al-Muhajir a grudge for replacing him as the governor of Africa. As a junior contemporary of the Prophet Muhammad, as well as the nephew of the conqueror of Egypt, Amr ibn al-As, Uqba tends to come off better. He is portrayed as a larger-than-life, swashbuckling character, and subsequently gained a cult following as the man who almost single-handedly conquered most of modern Algeria and Morocco in the name of Islam. There is still a shrine dedicated to him in central Algeria. "I have sold my soul to God Almighty," he said as he set off westward at breakneck speed, defeating army after army, finally reaching the Atlantic Ocean, where he railed against the enforced curtailment of his onslaught, bearing witness to God that if he could find a way to cross the sea and continue his conquests, he would surely do so. The failure of Byzantium and Persia to recover. In many ways, the initial success of the Arab conquests is not so surprising. With their mobility and manpower, steppe and desert tribes have frequently demonstrated their ability to strike hard and fast and make rapid gains. For instance, a 4th-century Saracen queen by the name of Mawiyah led her troops into Phoenicia and Palestine as far as the regions of Egypt, notching up victories wherever she went, so that in the end, the Romans found it necessary to send an embassy to her in order to solicit peace. And the Mongols were able to capture more landmass than any settled power in just 7 decades, 1206 to 1279. But once the military machinery of empire has finally been put into motion, it is normally able to halt the invaders in their tracks by virtue of its superior organizational capability, or to neutralize the threat by diplomacy and a range of incentives. So what went wrong for the empires in the 7th century, or, to look at it the other way, what went right for the Arabs? The total collapse of the Persian Empire seems particularly shocking, given that the Sasanian dynasty had managed it successfully for some 430 years. Persia certainly did not give up without a fight. Christian and Muslim historians allude to uprisings across Iran at different times in different cities. Ray, for example, reneged on its peace treaty with the Arabs on a number of occasions, and in 654 to 655, there was a widespread rebellion across northwest Iran, which involved the murder of the Arab agent responsible for tax collection. The insurgents of this rugged, mountainous region made use of the deep, forested valleys, the precipices, and the rocky peaks to lead furtive, guerrilla-style raids against their overlords. They assembled the surviving militia and organized into battalions, initiating a resistance movement that they hoped would free them from the teeth of the dragon. Their grievance was in part high taxes, and in part the abolition of the cavalry and the traditional office of prince of their country. Their tactics evidently bore fruit, at least for a while, for many Arabs perished in the rough terrain, and many were wounded from arrows in the impenetrable fens, which prompted them for a time to flee these lands. However, these and other revolts did not lead to a sustained reversal of Arab gains. The problem for Persia was that its extensive mountain ranges and deserts made large-scale coordinated action very difficult, and so the revolts remained local affairs rather than countrywide. It also meant that Iran was divided into numerous regions, each governed by different noble families and local lords. These had been bound together in a close alliance with the ruling Sasanian dynasty, but the disastrous defeat of Khusro II in 628 and the ensuing years of civil war loosened that alliance, and the death of Yazdgird led to its complete dissolution. The Byzantines were better placed than the Persians to withstand the Arab onslaught. In particular, whereas there was no natural barrier and very little distance between Arabia and the Persian capital, Seleucia Ctesiphon, the steep Taurus Mountains and some 600 miles separated the Byzantine capital from even the northernmost tip of the Syrian desert. Every year, the Arabs would send expeditions into Anatolia, but they would be forced to withdraw once the long, hard winter had set in, losing any gains they had made in the summer. On the downside, however, it was similarly problematic for the Byzantines to march an army all the way across Anatolia to Syria. All they could do was initiate sabotage operations along the southern and eastern Mediterranean littoral. The most successful of these missions was carried out in the late 670s and early 680s by the Emperor Constantine IV in response to a series of Arab sorties against Constantinople. He dispatched a guerrilla force, dubbed the Insurgents, Mardaites, which sailed to the coast of Tyre and Sidon. After disembarking, they made their way up into the Lebanese mountain range. There they won over to their cause the Jarajima, who were longtime residents of the Mount Amanus region around Antioch, described by a near contemporary as the armed men who from olden times had practiced banditry in the mountains of Lebanon. They had initially tried to stay out of the Arab-Byzantine wars, but when pressured by the Arabs, they grudgingly agreed to act as spies and frontier guards for them as long as they paid no taxes. They had no love of Arab rule, though, and so when the Mardaites encouraged them to revolt, they willingly agreed. In addition, many runaway slaves and Aramean peasants joined them so that in a short time their ranks swelled to many thousands. Once they had attained sufficient numbers, they spread from the mountains around Antioch in the north to the peaks around Galilee in the south, and from these heights they launched raids against the settled lands all around them. They were evidently very successful, and a real thorn in the Arab side, for when Abd al-Malik, faced with a major civil war at home, sought to renew the peace agreement made by his predecessors with Byzantium, one of his key requests was that the emperor should remove the host of the Mardaites from Lebanon and prevent their incursions. The Byzantines could therefore inflict losses on the Arab regime, especially on the settlements of the Mediterranean coast, but they could not translate this into a full-scale recovery of their former possessions. To march an army all the way from the coast across the mountains to Damascus was beyond their capacity, and once the Arabs had moved their capital to faraway Baghdad, the Byzantines' chances of a comeback were even slimmer. Muawiyah's rule. What one might have expected to happen, though, was not that Byzantium and Persia would simply march in to take back their lands, but that the Arab Empire would fragment into warring factions, as happened to many conquerors from the margins, such as the Turks in the late 6th century. Civil war did indeed afflict the Arabs on a number of occasions, but somehow they managed to stay together and maintain their hold over their newly acquired territories. To understand this achievement, it is crucial to bear in mind that though nomadic tribes contributed essential raw fighting power, the conquest leadership was not drawn from men innocent of civilization. They were principally from Yemen, which had a history of statehood stretching back more than 1.5 millennia, and from the oasis towns of central and northern West Arabia, which had had close ties with the provincial Roman Byzantine world for centuries. Muhammad himself had participated in trading journeys to Syria, and his tribe of Quraysh had numerous links to the Arab Christian tribes of that land. The conquerors were therefore no strangers to the business of government, even if they had not expected to find themselves in the driving seat. The first Arab ruler whose name is attested on coins, inscriptions, and documents, as well as in contemporary chronicles, is Muawiyah, the founder of the Umayyad dynasty, 661 to 750. So what do these sources tell us about his reign? In the first place, as one observer put it, he refused to go to the seat of Muhammad, that is, Medina, home to the Arab rulers before him, but preferred to make his capital at Damascus, where he had already been directing military operations for 20 years. Evidently, he recognized that it was not feasible to rule such a far-flung empire from such a remote location. This sounds like an eminently practical decision, but it was very likely a contentious one, given that Medina was where Muhammad had established his community. One of the key promises of Abdullah ibn al-Zubayr, the principal challenger to the Umayyads in the 680s, was that he would place Mecca and Medina once more at the heart of the Arab Empire, a pledge that won over many to his cause. Muawiyah's decision might not, however, have been solely a pragmatic one. He perhaps regarded his rule as a new beginning, and his son Yazid would certainly appear to have held that view, for he took the surprising step at the outset of his reign of stamping on his coins Year One of Yazid, rather than using the Hijra era that had become standard by his day, counting from the year in which Muhammad founded his community in Medina. It is very much in the tradition of ancient Middle Eastern kings and suggests that he did not see himself as a mere deputy of Muhammad. Second, Muawiyah paid attention to the problem of asserting central control over the vast lands to the east of Syria, which would be a thorn in the Umayyad side for a long time to come, and eventually bring about their downfall. His solution was to entrust them to a couple of men who were very close to him. Abdullah ibn Amr, who was of the same tribe and was married to a daughter of his, and subsequently Ziyad, who was the son of a concubine of his father, and whom Muawiyah formally adopted as his brother. The names of these two men appear on the coinage of the East for the years AD 661 to 674, AH 41 to 54. Ziyad's writ would seem to have extended particularly far, for he was able to have his coinage of 670 to 674 struck at more than 24 mints spread right across Iran, confirming the report of Muslim historians that he acted as Muawiyah's viceroy over all the eastern territories. He was also the first to add religious slogans in Arabic to the coinage, inscribing the phrase, "In the name of God my Lord, Bismillah Rabbi." His sons followed in his footsteps, and between them, this family ruled over a large portion of the East on behalf of Muawiyah and his son Yazid for almost 2 decades. Third, Muawiyah followed a laissez-faire policy toward the conquered peoples. He allowed everyone to live as they wanted, as one contemporary noted, and sought to reassure them that he was not hostile to their religions. For example, in recognition of the fact that the majority of his new subjects were Christian, he made the deliberate decision to have a number of Arab chiefs swear the oath of allegiance to him as leader in Jerusalem, and while there, he went up and sat down on Golgotha and prayed there. He also went to Gethsemane, and then went down to the tomb of the Blessed Mary and prayed in it. Moreover, Muawiyah made efforts to win over the Christian Arab elite of Syria, the likes of Sharahil ibn Zalim, whom we met in Chapter 1, who had invaluable experience of government. Many of them served as his senior advisors and administrators, such as the Mansur family of Damascus. Christian poets were frequent visitors to his court, and quite a number of his tribal backers were Christian. He himself married Maysoon, the daughter of the powerful Christian chief of Kalb, and she bore him the future caliph Yazid. The latter went on to marry 2 noble women of Ghassan, one of them allegedly the daughter of the last Christian Ghassanid king. Muawiyah did endeavor to implement a few pro-Muslim policies, in particular to remove the symbol of the cross from the coinage and to incorporate the Church of St. John the Baptist in Damascus within the mosque, but when the Christians protested, he apparently backed down. Finally, Muawiyah gave some thought to the economy. The conquests had given the Arabs access to large amounts of cash from taxes, tribute, and booty, but most of it was simply recycled directly to the army in the form of stipends, which were paid not only to the soldiers, but also to their families and dependents. In an account of the annual revenues and expenditure of southern Iraq in 670, we are informed that 60 million dirhams was collected in tax, of which 52 million went on stipends and rations to the military and their families. This amounts to 87% of total expenditure, which seems very high. Modern estimates for late Roman military expenditure range from a third to a half of state revenue, but certainly papyri from Umayyad Egypt give no indication of money being sent to the central treasury. So how did Muawiyah cover the expenses of his household, and how did he pay for the running of the state? The repair and maintenance of roads, bridges, and canals, the construction and manning of siege engines and ships, the manufacture and transport of equipment and goods. He had access to manpower from captives, slaves, and compulsory labor, but the papyri that record the requisitioning of